Would you describe your ministry as offering hospitality to strangers? Professor Christine Pohl asked the founder of a community for rural homeless people. No, not really, he said. Well, how would you describe what you do? Well, we welcome needy strangers into a home environment. We give them a safe place. I think hospitality, well, is entertaining family and friends, and that's not really what we're doing. This little snippet is taken from a conversation recorded in a lovely book on recovering the heart of Christian hospitality called Making Room. Hospitality is a word that over time has lost some of its meaning. Like the man quoted, we probably first think of it in its cozy sense of entertaining family and friends. Understandably, because that's the way we have experienced as people welcomed in to that warmth. Or we may think of it in its more impersonal sense, like the hospitality industry, which provides hospitality so long as you have a credit card to pay. Or maybe in its rather expensive sense, if one has recently hosted a wedding. Or perhaps in a rather transactional sense, as a way of impressing a client or other person we expect something from or somebody's expecting from us. But for ancient people, and certainly Bible people, hospitality had a rich moral component. It was an important virtue to practice hospitality, because hospitality was about welcoming the stranger in a generous way without expectation of payment in return. The Greek word used in the New Testament for hospitality is philoxenia. Philo, of course, is the word for love. And the second half, xenia, xenos, is the word for stranger. We're probably more familiar with it in its other use, which is xenophobic, which is fear of anything perceived as foreign. But in the Bible, Christians are particularly called to practice philoxenia, a love toward strangers. And the Greek word, of course, highlights that orientation even more than our word hospitality. Paul says in Romans, be constant in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show philoxenia. It's interesting, they're two different things, aren't they? Contributing to the needs of the saints and philoxenia. There's something about that hospitality that has a specific thing he wants the people to understand. Jesus will tell his followers, when you give a dinner or a banquet, don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Now, I honestly don't think Jesus had anything against giving a party for your friends and family. I think he spent a lot of time with his friends, eating with them. You know, surely not. But he is using a rabbinic kind of way of speaking, which really divides into two extremes to heighten the point he's making. He's sort of going from lesser. I know you all invite your friends over, and I know you have your family, you do a great job, but you know what? This is what hospitality in the kingdom of heaven is like. And it stretches us. It actually challenges us beyond our comfort zone. And there's no doubt about it, hospitality does stretch a person, even when there isn't that much cultural difference. I remember one of the most embarrassing things, which was when Richard and I were invited by the lovely president of Gordon Conwell and his wife for dinner. And on the way out, Richard grabbed a bottle of wine, and I grabbed one of those little gift bags, and we put it in there. And we arrived at the house, and we presented it to the president and his wife. And it was only when I saw her kind but stricken face that I recalled that, of course, Gordon Conwell is an institution whose founders abstained from alcohol, and that it was a dry campus. I mean, as a cradle Episcopalian, I'd not really considered the denominational or even their domestic piety and how different it was than mine. But they were very gracious about it. I'm just saying, you know, mistakes will be made when we enter into love of the stranger. But you know, better to make mistakes than to miss the opportunity that God gives us in this rich practice. So, speaking of awkwardness and reward, let's look at that wonderful, marvelous story about strange hospitality in 1 Kings, about Elijah and the widow of Zarephath. The background of this story is that after the reign of King Solomon, the kingdom of Israel divided into two nations. The north was called Israel, and the south, the part that holds Jerusalem, was called Judah. The northern kingdom quickly embraced idolatrous worship. And it came to a climax under the rule of King Ahab, who married Jezebel from Phoenicia, a prosperous land to the north whose people worshiped Baal, a god of rain and fertility. Well, things in Israel got very ugly indeed. In fact, under Ahab's rule, one of his architects rebuilt the city of Jericho, but in doing it, he ritually sacrificed his oldest son as he laid the foundation of the city. And he ritually sacrificed his youngest son when he built the gates. But Ahab took no notice of these atrocities because the country was prosperous, and he figured it's working out to worship Baal and the God of Israel. This is until Elijah the Tishbite came on the scene. Elijah spoke out against King Ahab's Baal worship, and eventually Elijah fasted and pronounced a curse upon the whole kingdom. No more rain, unless they stopped worshiping Baal. And then he would speak again and end the curse. It was a curse that, of course, was tailor-made to expose the inadequacy of Baal, the god of rain, in comparison to the one true God who had created and sustained and loved Israel all along. It was a curse that also, of course, caused much deprivation, and not just for Israel, the land that was cursed, but the surrounding lands too, this famine. But Elijah wanted his people to turn back to the true God. During the period of no rain, God sent Elijah to live by a little stream, and when that dried up, he told him to go to Sidon, where a widow would take care of him. This is where the story gets really interesting and where we pick up this morning. First of all, Sidon was the epicenter of Baal worship. The woman wasn't even Jewish. She might have even been worshiping the false god, Baal, that Elijah was contending with. Yet the scriptures say
that God
reported to Elijah that he had commanded her in advance to welcome him. Furthermore, the woman is destitute. She and her son are starving, and Elijah shows up asking for bread. Actually, he's even going to say, yeah, before you prepare those last little granules for you and your son, we're about to die, I would like to have a cake made for me. Just reading the story on its surface level, we are struck by the strangeness of the situation, by the fact that God has communicated somehow to this pagan woman in another country. How, we wonder, was it a dream? How did she know? How did she hear the Lord? And by the fact that through generous, trusting hospitality, the woman, as well as Elijah and her son, are mysteriously sustained. God has blessed this unlikely welcome that he orchestrated. But there's more to consider. A 4th-century theologian named Ephrem the Syrian says this: God sends Elijah to the city of pagan people in order to change his hardness into mercy. Ephrem goes on to say in his commentary that while God had given his servant Elijah power to curse the land, God was ever on the side of the suffering, and of course, particularly the widow. We see this in Jesus, as he alone sees that widow who is stretched to her last penny. God sees the suffering, and he was hopeful that an in-person meeting with this faithful widow might soften Elijah up a bit. The commentary goes on: when he found her barefoot and dressed in rags in the act of gathering some wood, wasted by starvation and made miserably thin, he had the impression of seeing a burnt stick. And he was ashamed of asking her for bread. So first he asked her for water. Later he asked her for bread. He knew for sure that a jug of flour would not be lacking, thanks to the promise of the Lord. Now, I love this little commentary. It's quite bold and imaginative. But actually, when you read those very early commentaries, they are kind of bold and imaginative. Ephrem the Syrian was known as the harp of the spirit, and we can see his poetic flair in his commentary and the description of the woman and how he's thought about her. But pertaining to our topic of hospitality, he uncovers a marvelous truth. There's a strange reversal that often happens in the giving and receiving of hospitality with strangers. Sometimes the guest sustains the giver, and the giver becomes the receiver. Both are blessed in unexpected ways by the presence of God in their midst. The widow, as it turns out, was lifted from her condition of starvation, and later in the story, she watched the God of Israel heal her son through the prayers of Elijah. But Elijah also received something. He endured, and I say endured because I think it might have been awkward for Elijah. I'll only find out in heaven. He endured dependence on a faithful woman who was not one of his people. He observed her suffering. And he also watched her emaciated stick-like body gather food, water, bake, clean, tend her child, and set food before him. Day after day, his heart was open to a stranger. And this was a spiritual gift to Elijah, a gift of God's own heart, a gift of God's way of seeing this widow that society had neglected. There are many stories in the Bible that unfold in the context of hospitality and always have sort of a mysterious twist. We know that Abraham entertains angels unaware, and we remember Jesus telling a parable about sheep that are really people. And he talks about them feeding him when he was hungry. And when they reply that they never remember doing any such thing, That's some of you, by the way. He says that whenever they did it for someone in need, they had done it for him. This claim that Jesus makes, that when we show hospitality to a stranger or a person in need, we are ministering to the Lord himself. It's stunning that he wants to be our guest. It's stunning that he wants to be our host. One final image for you to take into the week. On the night of the Passover, the night Jesus will command his beloved disciples to love one another, on the night he tells them to practice breaking bread and drinking wine together in remembrance of him, he says this: I have eagerly desired to eat this meal with you before I suffer. Eager desire to be with them. Eager desire to see their faces. Eager desire to hear their dumb jokes. Eager desire to hear their voices. This Jesus, he is all about loving the stranger. And may we practice this in his name. Amen.